Railroaded was created and produced by the Free Ross team. I'm allowing them to use my podcast to reach a wider audience and hopefully raise awareness of Ross's plight and his fight for clemency. This is the best chance to stop Ross spending the rest of his life in prison. The information presented in Railroaded is based solely on the public record and should not be attributed to myself, Ross Ulbricht, Lynn Ulbricht, or anyone connected with FreeRoss.org. I'm not responsible and do not verify for accuracy any of the information contained within this series. While I'm close to the case due to my interviews with Lynn, I've not been involved in any of the production of the series. There will be additional information about the case and links to my previous interview with Lynn in the show notes and information on how you can help support the campaign at the end of the show. If you have any questions, feel free to get in touch.
Railroaded. The Targeting and Caging of Ross Ulbricht. Episode 2 of a 6-part series. This episode includes chapters 6 through 10, Thwarting Der Jägen, Being Wonderful, The Setup, Closing In, and New York Takes Over. Chapter 6, Thwarting Der Jägen. Stephen Duke, North American Events Manager for Students for Liberty, said, "This case is also very much about the future of privacy and surveillance, and sets some dangerous precedents for those who want to open digital marketplaces or use digital currencies." By this time, Der Jägen's investigation was derailed, leaving him with no seizures and Karpeles scrambling to escape the government's pursuit. However, Der Jägen was sure he had his man, and continued to doggedly pursue him. On May 17, 2013, a conference call occurred among Der Jägen and AUSA Crickbaum from Chicago, McFarland and AUSA Herring from Baltimore, and AUSA Kay, who had helped Bridges go rogue and seize Karpeles' money. During the call, Kay stated he was trying to work on an interview with Karpeles. Crickbaum asked what the purpose of the interview was. Kay replied that he wanted to know more about Karpeles' money business and to ask him directly about his knowledge of Silk Road. Der Jägen expressed serious concern over that approach and over Kay using his information developed on Karpeles for his own use. Kay agreed to hold off for several months while Der Jägen prepared his indictment. Even with Kay's assurance, Der Jägen was worried that he would go behind his back again and expressed this to McFarland. McFarland reassured him that he had complete control over Kay, and he was the one to decide whether or not Karpeles would be interviewed, that he would honor Der Jägen's request to not pursue or interview Karpeles. On another conference call 2 months later, Der Jägen specifically asked Herring if there were any developments with Karpeles, and Kay specifically if there were any more talks about meetings. Herring said there was not. Once again, Der Jägen's trust in his colleagues was misplaced. Unknown to him, they were working out their own deal with Karpeles. In fact, on July 8th, the day before telling Der Jägen there would be no meeting, Herring was notified by Kay that a face-to-face meeting was going to take place between him and Karpeles' attorney. Neither Kay nor Herring notified Der Jägen or told him about the meeting when he specifically asked. 2 days later, Kay met in person with Karpeles' attorneys. During the meeting, Karpeles' lawyers brought up Silk Road and stated that Karpeles was willing to tell them who he suspects is currently running the website in order to relieve him of any potential charges. Kay then proceeded to arrange a meeting overseas with Karpeles himself. That same evening, Der Jägen met with McFarland and Herring in preparation for a coordination meeting the next day, yet neither mentioned the meeting planned with Karpeles or his lawyers. At the coordination meeting, yet another law enforcement office was brought in. FBI New York, represented by their lead investigator, Christopher W. Tarbell, and Southern District of New York AUSA Saren Turner, along with multiple DOJ and CCSIP attorneys. Tarbell brought an important piece of the government's investigation to the table: the location of the server hosting Silk Road. It was in Iceland, and Tarbell said he was seeking a copy of it from the Reykjavik Metropolitan Police. Force and Bridges now had reason to fear that any communications between themselves and DPR would be accessible to Tarbell. Der Jägen briefed his entire case to the group, and once again identified Karpeles as their main target, and the man behind DPR and the Silk Road. The CCSIP attorney overseeing the meeting asked if any other office had any case on Karpeles. All the Baltimore attendees, including McFarland, Herring, Herring's supervisor, and Bridges, all remained silent, despite knowing that a meeting had just taken place with Karpeles' attorneys the day before. The CCSIP attorney went on to say that, since the information Der Jagen shared was brought in good faith, that no other office should attempt to pursue Karpeles. Chapter 7. Being Wonderful. Alex Winter, director of the Deep Web documentary, said, "The Silk Road and case of Ross Ulbricht speak to some of the most important and contentious issues of our day. Citizens' rights in the digital age, government surveillance and overreach, and the often extreme and unfair sentences in cyber-related criminal cases." With the Silk Road server location in hand, there was a lot of pressure from the U.S. Attorney's Office to find DPR and take down the site. Der Jagen redoubled his efforts, knowing he'd lose Karpeles if he did not arrest him before the site was taken down. To this end, he and another HSI agent created a new identity on the Silk Road forum named Mr. Wonderful. Mr. Wonderful then approached the forum administrators who regularly spoke with DPR in an attempt to turn them into informants. One admin, Cirrus, was compromised by Mr. Wonderful and recruited to cooperate against the site and DPR. Eventually, Der Jagen took over the Cirrus account. As DPR's employee, he interacted with him daily, in search of any clue he could use to expose him. Once again, Der Jagen mistakenly entrusted his colleagues in Baltimore with knowledge of this operation, and one of them took advantage of it with a scheme of their own. It remains unknown if this person was Force, Bridges, Kay, several working together, or someone else entirely, but whoever it was created an account named Not Wonderful and contacted DPR. Not Wonderful told DPR he could provide real-time information and analysis regarding the federal investigation of Silk Road and DPR. In the following months, Not Wonderful sold DPR intimate details pertaining to the investigation, including details of Der Jagen's Mr. Wonderful operation. There is a fixation on somehow penetrating or compromising your moderators through bribing or threatening them into providing access to a staff account, he told DPR. They seem to be under pressure to get someone of great importance to show a win for USA. Not Wonderful outlined the agencies going after DPR. I'm trying to warn you, the DEA, ICE, Postal Inspector, NSI, FBI, CIA, NSA are itching to get credit for your arrest. DPR paid Not Wonderful in bitcoins every week for ongoing updates on the investigation. Chapter 8. The Setup. Catherine Fitz, Assistant Secretary of Housing under President George H.W. Bush, said, "Ross Ulbricht was framed. The feds who framed him broke a lot of laws and made a complicated mess." Eventually, Herring informed Der Jagen about the meeting Kay had with Karpeles' attorneys and the plans to meet with Karpeles himself. Once again, Der Jagen told Herring that he did not want him to pursue Karpeles or meet with him, that it would damage his ongoing investigation. But by now, Der Jagen had lost control, and Karpeles was already working closely with Baltimore. Kay changed the meeting location to Guam, widely known as an NSA stronghold. Der Jagen continued to express deep concern over this meeting and its effect on his investigation against Karpeles, but Herring did not appear concerned or willing to stop it. Unbeknownst to Der Jagen, his colleagues in Baltimore and New York had already determined that Karpeles would not be the target. Force and Bridges learned in advance that law enforcement intended to make an arrest of DPR, thereby giving them ample time to work him. This allowed DPR to formulate and implement an escape plan that incriminated Ross. Exactly what Karpeles told Kay remains unknown, but it is established that he offered Kay someone to target as DPR instead of himself in exchange for legal immunity. Ross was the perfect fall guy, because after all, Silk Road was his idea, and he trusted DPR enough to hand his creation off to him early on. It would take just over 2 months after Karpeles met with Kay for the government to apprehend Ross. As stated in court documents, with pressure mounting toward the end of 2013, because the government had access to Silk Road's servers but permitted the site to continue operating, they seized on Ross as DPR, thereby letting Karpeles escape and leave Ross as the wrongly prosecuted culprit. Just as Bridges had set up Green to take the fall for his theft, Ross was set up to take the fall for the entire operation of Silk Road. DPR, who purchased and was leaked information about the government's investigation of Silk Road, framed Ross to absorb the consequences. In order to issue subpoenas and warrants, and ultimately indict Ross, the government had to provide an explanation of why he was DPR and how they found him. Known as parallel construction, this is a tactic used by law enforcement as a means of disguising how an investigation began. In Ross's case, the government's explanation was that a forum post containing Ross's email address was suddenly discovered on Karpeles' website, bitcointalk.org, by IRS agent Gary Alford, using a simple date-restricted Google search. Despite Der Yeagan's tireless and lengthy Silk Road investigation, and his finding that the first posting about Silk Road appeared on Karpeles' forum on March 1, 2011, by a user named Silk Road, Alford claimed he found evidence of an even earlier post, dated January 29, 2011, by a user named Altoid. However, Alford couldn't have found this earlier post because it didn't exist. Rather, he testified that he found a quote of this post within another user's post talking about Silk Road. Alford then said he found a subsequent post by Altoid, dated October 11, 2011, that appeared to be a help wanted ad for a Bitcoin startup company that listed the contact information rossulbricht@gmail.com. According to the government's version of events, this post is what led them to suspect that Ross was behind Silk Road. However, it would have been simple for Karpeles, or anyone else with high-level access to BitcoinTalk.org, to plant this information. Alford's official story defies belief. Finding Ross's email address this way was like finding a needle in a haystack the size of the internet. It was a task that scores of investigative journalists, extortionists, hackers, and numerous law enforcement agencies had tried and failed at for years. On the other hand, if he was provided with the information in advance, it would have been like finding the needle with a high-powered magnet. With Ross's email address in hand and an explanation linking it to Silk Road, all that remained was tracking down his physical location. Chapter 9. Closing In. William Binney, former high-level NSA official turned whistleblower, said, "The government can use an email address or phone number without a warrant to get an IP address to go into the database and scarf up everything about the user." Just 10 days before his arrest, Secret Service and FBI agents and Turner, the New York prosecutor, used a combination of technologies to intercept and collect Ross's internet traffic information. These technologies fall under two categories, pen registers and trap and trace devices, which collect outgoing and incoming data respectively. Together, they are known as a pen trap. Turner first collected, without a warrant, all outgoing data from Ross's email address in search of the internet protocol, IP addresses being used to access the account. An IP address is a unique number used on the internet that allows data to be routed between connected devices. Turner discovered one particular IP address being serviced by Comcast. He subpoenaed Comcast to reveal the home address of the subscriber, which turned out to be a row house in South San Francisco, where Ross was renting a room. Having physically located Ross with nothing more than his email address, Turner then remotely attached a pen trap to the wireless router in Ross's living room. This pen trap collected all internet traffic traveling through Ross's home router. In that traffic, he discovered the MAC address of Ross's laptop and attached a pen trap to it, too. This gave him the ability to geolocate Ross and collect all his internet traffic information, regardless of where he went. Turner never obtained a warrant for any of these searches and seizures. Alford's story was not nearly enough to establish probable cause, the standard necessary for securing one. Instead, Turner relied on the third-party doctrine, an outdated legal theory established in 1979 that says that individuals relinquish their privacy rights to the phone numbers they dial because they have voluntarily given them to the telephone company. According to Turner, government agents can secretly rummage through everyone's internet traffic information without restraint, just as he did to Ross, because it is sent through an internet service provider or third party. Something as socially, politically, and personally important as website browsing history requires updated consideration of privacy rights by this court before the government is given license to search it without probable cause, the National Lawyers Guild wrote to the Supreme Court, challenging this violation in Ross's case. The Cato Institute and Reason Foundation argued that the government's warrantless collection of the IP addresses a citizen visits is analogous to a government agent peering through the window to monitor which books a person pulls from their shelf. This power effectively gives the government a blank check to conduct a dragnet search of internet activity. With Ross's internet data, Turner was able to gather enough circumstantial evidence to suggest that Ross was logging on and off at times similar to when DPR was logging on and off. This was enough to secure an arrest warrant. Chapter 10. New York Takes Over. Joshua Dreitel, criminal defense attorney, said, "The government did not produce a single witness to testify firsthand that Ulbricht authored any of the communications attributed to DPR. It was all digital, created and transmitted on an anonymous, untraceable internet network." Der Yeagan, still the most senior and experienced Silk Road investigator, was not convinced that Ross was DPR. Despite Alford's story, he continued to believe Karpeles was behind Silk Road. After 2 years and thousands of hours of investigation, time was running out to indict him before the site was taken down and Ross given the blame. Der Yeagan submitted an affidavit attached to a search warrant for Karpeles' email accounts so he could gather the evidence he needed to convict him. He swore under oath, "I believe that Karpeles has been involved in establishing and operating the Silk Road website. He has participated in a conspiracy to distribute narcotics in violation of United States code. Further, by operating Mt. Gox, while knowing that a large volume of its business derives from narcotics trafficking activity conducted through Silk Road, Karpeles has violated U.S. money laundering laws. I believe the email accounts will contain communications between Karpeles and the co-conspirators involved with him in committing the subject offenses." Turner would go on to seal Der Yeagan's warrant against public scrutiny, stating that, if made public, it would alert Karpeles to law enforcement interest, and that notification of the existence of this order will seriously jeopardize the investigation. Ultimately, none of Der Yeagan's efforts mattered. By the end of September 2013, with Ross's arrest imminent, he realized that if he'd have anything to show for his years of work, he had to cooperate with the prosecution led by Pritender Bharara, U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York, who was recommended for his powerful job by Schumer and was his chief counsel for nearly 5 years. As Der Yeagan told his supervisor at Homeland Security, Philip Osborne, I think there's room to avoid the drama by, instead of dwelling on the past, talking about how to make HSI in general walk away from this without looking like complete fools. Baltimore can easily erase a lot of the damage they've done by cooperating with Barrara. They can have sloppy seconds on Ross for their murder for hire. They can also have some info on other Bitcoin companies that Karpeles might name as shady after we get done with him. That's the best that can be given, and they should consider themselves lucky for getting anything close to that. Or we can just stall, and Baltimore gets nothing, and we contributed to Karpeles and Barr getting away. We'll get no HSI banner on the site, and we'll probably get no cooperation from Barrara with any information related to Karpeles. If Ross names Karpeles in the interview, and we didn't help them get Karpeles and Barr when we had the chance, Barrara will leave us out of it and tie him into their conspiracy. We will then be left dealing with Baltimore's tears. I think it's important we help them have a come-to-Jesus moment, otherwise our agency loses as a whole. It's a simple sell if they know the alternative is they will be left with absolutely nothing. No matter how much they whine and complain to HSI HQ, it won't stop Barrara prosecuting all of them without any of us. Der Yeagan's investigation of Karpeles had finally ground to a halt. He would never get to examine any of Karpeles' electronic devices, or servers, or any of his other email accounts. To be continued. Next episode will include chapters 11 to 14, The Arrest, Deleting Evidence, Fighting for Freedom, and Finding the Servers. For a written version of this episode, plus citations and footnotes, go to freeross.org/railroaded.
Thank you for listening. If you're interested in the case and you want to help support the family, there's a few things you can do. You can share this episode out with your friends and family on social media. Visit my website page for the episode, which is linked from the homepage. You'll be able to watch the YouTube version, which includes supporting imagery. You can visit the Free Ross website to find out more information on the case, which is at freeross.org. You can follow the Free Ross campaign on Twitter, @free_Ross. You can follow Ross on Twitter, @RealRossU, you just being the letter U. You can sign the petition for clemency. There's a link on the homepage of the website which takes you through where you can do this. You can also make a donation and buy something from the Free Ross website. And if you have any questions, feel free to get in touch.